I want to talk about Naaman in 2 Kings 6 and 2 Kings 5. Now in the Septuagint, these two chapters are the other way round. 2 Kings 6 comes first, and then 2 Kings 5. And reading and rereading them, that makes sense to me the more I read them. And I leave you to read the chapters and figure that for yourself. Because in 2 Kings 6, we have the king of Syria warring against Israel, and he has some success. We're told in 2 Kings chapter 5 that God gave him success against Israel. And it would seem that it's during those raids that they were making into Israel that the king of Syria had captured this maid who was to be the personal servant of Naaman's family. That sort of makes sense. And I think that the whole message of all this really is how God works through the despised and the humble. Because that girl was apparently alone. Probably her parents had been killed. It was taken as absolutely normal that if you took a female captive, you raped her. That was absolutely the law of the jungle at that time. She would have been raped, probably seen her parents, family, her brothers killed. And there she was, the personal servant to the captain of the army of the king of Syria, Naaman, and his wife. And yet it is through her that God not only saves Naaman from his sickness, but God also eventually saves Naaman. And we might think that Naaman would be the most unlikely person to convert. There he was, the captain of the army of the king of Syria, the enemy of Israel, leading the raids into Israel. But you see how God has a number on everybody, potentially. So one takeaway from this is don't give up on anybody. Don't think that, oh, no, she just would never be interested. Oh, no, he just isn't that type of person. There's a hole in every human heart which only the gospel can really fill. And there is that subconscious need in people. There is that subconscious interest, potentially, in the message of the cross of Jesus. And even at this time in the Old Testament, the message of the kingdom of God, of the God of Israel, was all the same. Likewise, the thing, the only thing that could meet man's hidden need, his ultimate needs. And it's the same today. So never give up. Never think that nobody's interested. People are more interested than they appear. And I'd like to just make the observation that in 2 Kings 6, the man of God, that's Elisha, keeps telling the king of Israel, don't go to such and such a place, the Syrians are going to be there. And the Syrians figure that there's somebody in Israel who knows all our military movements. And yet, 2 Kings 5, verse 1, which I suggest comes before 2 Kings 6, now Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Syria, was very honoured and thought of highly by the king of Syria, because by him Yahweh had given victory to Syria. And you see the complex way in which God works. On one hand, he gave victory to the Syrians, military victory. And yet, on the other hand, Elisha was sending to the king of Israel saying, look, don't go there. You're going to fall into an ambush at the hands of the Syrians. And the Syrians realized that. So it's as if God is, on one hand, blessing the Syrian military. And on the other hand, he is helping the Israelites to avoid defeat by them. It reminds me of Passover night, where Yahweh's destroyer angel went out to kill all the firstborn in Egypt, including the Israelites. But for those who were obedient to God's word, there was another angel who hovered over, literally passed over. The idea is really who hovered over the homes of the obedient Israelites who killed the lamb, etc., and put the blood on the doorposts. And that angel preserved them from the destroying angel. Now, the point to note is that all these things are under God's control. There's no sinful angels and good angels. It's all under his control. There is no radical evil in the cosmos. There is no personal devil, as is often thought, with minions of evil angels and demons and so forth. If that's news to you, have a search online for my book, The Real Devil, and I'll discuss that in more detail there. But for now, I just want to make the point that God's ways of working are incredibly complex. Most of them, I suppose, unperceived by us. And I think those who accuse God of injustice are failing to humbly appreciate that. They lack humility because they don't see all the complex workings and fine balancings of God's actions. They decide he's unjust, but that is no more really than a child thinking that a loving parent isn't fair. That's all it comes down to. They don't perceive, we do not perceive, the intricate way in which God is working. So, another big thing about all this thing is the message of humility. As I said, it was through that abused captive girl that Naaman was sent. And she clearly had faith in Elisha, because we learn from Luke 4:27 that there were many lepers in Israel at that time, but none of them had been cured. None of them had been cured. Now, when the girl sees that Naaman has got leprosy, she says, "I know that the God of Israel can cure him." But she says that by faith because there had been no previous case of leprosy in Israel in her lifetime being cured. And we're told again in Luke 4:27 that Elisha was sent to him, to Naaman. Well, yeah, Naaman came to him. But you see how in the bigger picture, God was sending Elisha to him. And how did he do that sending? By sending this raped, probably teenage girl into captivity and using her and using the way that her faith had remained, despite, I guess, having all sorts of questions about the justice of God and the fairness of what had happened to her. And Naaman was only really cured by humbling himself. It's really quite unusual for an enemy, as Syria was the enemy of Israel, and had carried its people off into captivity, to then come, in fact, to the king of Israel, offering lots of money so that their army general could be cured by one of their prophets, one of their holy men. So again, there was an element of humility in that, and I suppose that Naaman and the king of Syria had first got whiff of the greatness of Yahweh and Elisha by the way that they kept on finding that their military manoeuvres were known by the Israelites, that clearly God knew. The God of Israel is a God who knows. And I think that they were led by that to this faith that Elisha could in fact cure Naaman of his leprosy. So Naaman, 2 Kings 5:9, comes with his horses and his chariots and stands at the door of the house of Elisha. Is the enemy of Israel with his army surrounding the house of Elisha. And Elisha doesn't even go out and talk to him. He sends his servant to talk to him and say, "Yeah, just go and dip yourself 7 times in the River Jordan and you'll be good." And of course, Naaman is kind of offended. "Why don't you even come out and talk to me?" But he was again being tempted and tested, and his humility being developed. And he goes away in a huff. He expects something dramatic, but God doesn't prefer to work in dramatic ways, but in humble ways. And he says, "Aren't the rivers of Damascus far better? I've got to go and dip myself in this muddy little Jordan River." It wasn't a huge river, and it still isn't to this day. You can easily, many points of it, you can see the other side of it very easily. You can walk across it in places depending on the time of year. And he stomps off. But then again, the test of humility. His servants come to him just as the little girl had been one of his servants, and they say, why don't you do what he is telling you to do? And you wonder if those servants were also captive Israelites. And he does humble himself and listens to his servants, which is not something that great men like to do. And then he's told, dip yourself seven times. Now just imagine it. First time, second time, nothing happens. Third time, nothing happens. Fourth time, nothing happens. Oh, what's this? Game. Fifth time, nothing happens. Sixth time. Oh, nah, this is just poking fun at me. Okay, seventh time. Oh, and he's cured. You think about a few other things that required six or seven incidents before the miracle comes. Elijah praying for rain on Mount Carmel, 1 Kings 18:43. It was only his seventh prayer that led to the cloud carrying rain appearing. 2 Kings 4, the child sneezed seven times and then is resurrected. Jericho, they had to circle it for 6 days and then victory on the seventh. So why is there this delay in answered prayer? Why is there this requirement for going through processes a number of times before the answer comes? And I think it's quite clearly to develop our faith, our hope, and especially our humility. And the Jordan, the River Jordan, means literally the descender, that which brings down. And I think that, again, that is all part of this, that he had to be brought down, he had to be humbled so that he could be saved. And when he is cured, he turns to the God of Israel. He wants to take some soil from Israel back to his country because he still has the limited idea that the God of Israel only operates in Israel. And he wants to, all the same, be part of Israel. He converts to the God of Israel. And we're left to wonder quite how he got on in the future in that difficult situation he was in. He says, end of chapter 5, may Yahweh pardon your servant when my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there and he leans on my hand and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. May Yahweh pardon your servant for doing this. And Elisha says, go in peace, that's okay. I think you see there a nail in the coffin of any belief in guilt by association. This was a concession, and I think it shows how you can live God's truth on different levels. Can you imagine Daniel doing that? No, he didn't. He took the higher level. He said, I'm not going to even eat meat that has even been offered to an idol. Even though you could say it's just symbolic, there's no real meaning to it. He said, no, I'm not going to touch that. When the command was made to all bow down to the great statue that Nebuchadnezzar had raised up, the three friends refused to. What about the other Jews? Well, they all bowed down, didn't they? Quite clearly. It was just those three who didn't. And so, does that mean that they're the only people in the whole of Babylon, out of all the Jews, who shall be saved? No, not at all. And so, as I say, you see how people can live God's truth on different levels. And in fairness, there will be different levels of response in God's kingdom. Some stars will shine brighter than others, and one will have more cities to reign over than another. That's not because God is that interested in works per se, but it is simply a case that we can serve God on different levels. And in this case, God allowed Naaman to bow down to Rimmon, to the idol Rimmon, under peer pressure. God allows him to do that, even though he is really saying that he no longer believes in Rimmon and he believes in the God of Israel. Now, this is what causes so much interpersonal friction in church life, because people like to think that everyone has got to understand God and serve God on my level. And if somebody is apparently more committed than them, then they get jealous about them and get cranky with them, and lo and behold, you have division and argument based on jealousy, etc. And if somebody serves God on a lower level, oh, they're apostate. Oh, look, they're breaking biblical commandments. Yeah, you think how Mordecai refused to even bow down to Haman. And yet here, well, Naaman is allowed to bow down to an idol. So there are these different levels. And I think Christian maturity is about recognizing that. And as Jesus said, he came not to stump out a smouldering flax, but to fan it into life. And that's how we've got to see those who may be serving God on a lower level, perhaps in some ways, in some areas of life, than maybe we are. That's how it is. And as I say, it is the ultimate Christian maturity to accept them. He that is weak in the faith, Paul says in Romans, receive, but not to endless arguments and judgment of him. Because that is, of course, how God acts with each of us.